We'll be in session 15, but we actually have to go back to session 14 to pick up some of the things we didn't get to last week. So we'll be doing just a little bit of review from last week, and then we'll jump into some new material to finish out session 14, and then we'll get into session 15 a little bit later. A couple of bookkeeping matters. First of all, I usually have a study guide a week in advance. The next 2 weeks, that's not going to be the case. The closer I get to summer, the busier my schedule gets, and I just couldn't get those done. I couldn't get next week's done this week. So we'll be getting session 16 next week and then session 17 on Wednesday. I also got an email from someone asking me, it's April and you're stuck in Revelation 13. Are you planning to finish the book this month? And the answer to that question is no. We will be finishing what I don't get covered this month at our VBS in June. So my goal is, at the bare minimum, to get through Revelation 20. Hopefully we'll have a little bit of time at the end to get into 21 and 22, but I'm assuming that 21 and 22 are more familiar to everyone. So if we don't get to those two chapters, I'm not going to be too concerned about it. But I definitely want to get us down through chapter 20 in our VBS in June. But tonight we're in session 14. We're about two-thirds of the way through the slides here. And we're talking about the second beast in Revelation 13, this beast that looks like a lamb but talks like a dragon. And as we talked about last week, I believe that this beast represents the office of the papacy. And I connect this piece of imagery together with something that Paul says in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 3 and 4, and then skipping down to verse 9. When he talks about a day, the day when Jesus will return, and how that day will be preceded by a time of apostasy, a falling away, and then that apostasy will lead to the revealing of who Paul calls the man of sin, the son of perdition. And this particular, we'll just call him personage, sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. And this person, I guess you might say, comes to power through the working of Satan with all power, signs, and lying wonders. And one of the things that we connected in last week was when Pope Urban II in 1095 called for the First Crusade. And in that, in the quotation from that speech, we noticed some of the claims that he made, that he was the chief bishop and prelate over the whole world, how he was speaking on behalf of the Lord, how he was commanding people to take up arms in the name of Jesus Christ to not convert people to Jesus, not take the gospel to the Muslim land, but rather to drive those people out and kill as many as they could. And as an incentive, he offered the forgiveness of sins, the remission of sins, something that God alone, an authority that God alone retains. And we talked about the implications from this speech, how he's calling armies to battle in the name of Jesus Christ. In the name of the Prince of Peace, he is calling people to war. He couches it as a command from God. He says, moreover, Christ commands it. And he offers the forgiveness of sins. And I ask you to recall when Jesus healed the paralytic that was lowered through the roof of that home, and he forgave the man's sins, and his critics who were sitting by and watching him very closely thought to themselves, well, who can forgive sins but God? Well, that's actually a true observation, isn't it? And it's only because Jesus is the Son of God that he had the power and authority to forgive sins. So here we have a man in Pope Urban who is claiming to have authority that God reserves for himself alone. And we see in that speech the two horns of his power, the spiritual authority he holds over the church, but also we see him speaking as a king, as a ruler of this world. And to me, this is just an example of blasphemy that goes right along with the first beast in Revelation 13, verse number 6. Then the beast opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name. And again, I see all of this as coordinated behind the scenes by the dragon, by Satan. And we left off last week with this quotation from 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verses 13 through 15, where Paul says that false apostles were circulating among the early church. And let's not forget that the Bishop of Rome claims to have apostolic succession, that he is sitting on the same throne as Peter, who they count as the first bishop of the Church of Rome, which is a completely false historical narrative. And in this quotation, Paul just points out that here you have men who are claiming to be apostles, claiming to be sent from God, and that should not surprise us, because this is how Satan chooses to operate. Even Satan, the prince of darkness, can present himself as an angel of light. So you have false prophets who Jesus describes as wolves in sheep's clothing. You have a beast who is a dragon clothed as a lamb. You have Satan who is a dragon who clothes himself as an angel of light. So we see the same sorts of machinations happening with this second beast, that he appears to be allied with Jesus, but in fact, the real power behind him is the power of Satan. And that brings us into our new material for this week. We're still in session number 14. And if you're wondering where we are, we're about to look at the slide that says he performs great signs. So we'll look at that here in just a moment once we've read chapter 13, verses 13 and 14. Still talking about the second beast. He performed great signs so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. All right. This second beast performed great signs. Yes, again, we're in session 14. This is the heading, he performed great signs. And what this means is this beast is deceptive. He uses methods that appear to be supernatural. They appear to be from God. And there is no greater sign than the power to call down fire from heaven. Remember, this is how God chose to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah in Genesis chapter 19, verse 24. Elijah, when he challenged the prophets of Baal and Asherah on Mount Carmel, called down fire from heaven. And the apostles wanted to destroy a city that resisted the message of Jesus Christ by commanding fire to come down from heaven, following the example of Elijah. So here is an entity, here is a being who shows one of the typical signs we might expect to come from God, calling down fire from heaven. And he does this in the sight of the beast. He's talking about the first beast here, or in his presence. What this seems to suggest to me in verse 12 is that these two beasts are coordinated. They are working together. They complement one another. They are in cahoots, so to speak. And you'll remember that the second beast is the papacy and the first beast is the evolving Roman power that eventually becomes the Catholic Church, that ultimate evolution in power. So you have the papacy working together with the Catholic Church. When someone asked me last week why I'm separating out the papacy from the Catholic Church, and the reason I am is because the papacy claims not just to be the head of the Catholic Church, the papacy claims to be the head over all Christendom. We all understand that, right? That the papacy even believes to have authority over the people in this building, that we are just errant children who have left the fold. So yes, he is a part of the Catholic Church, but that office has historically claimed to have far more authority than just over the Catholic Church. That's why I think separating the two of them out is very useful, not only because I think it fits the symbolism, but also it just seems to be consistent with the way things have transpired historically speaking. So let's talk for a moment about these deceitful signs, these lying wonders. And I pulled a quote from one of the commentaries that I use that I would recommend to anyone. It's called The Four Views of Revelation. It's compiled by Stephen Gregg, and basically he takes the four major interpretations of Revelation, the preterist view, the futurist view, the continuous historical perspective view, which I've been teaching, and what's known as the spiritual view, and puts them side by side so that you can compare and contrast how the four views look at Revelation differently. And in his commentary, he offers this. There are few movements to this day talking about the Catholic Church that have claimed more signs and miracles to their endorsement. Images have come down and lit their own candles. Crucifixes have spoken. Idols have sweat, turned their eyes, moved their hands, opened their mouths, healed sicknesses, raised the dead, mended broken bones. The stigmata has appeared on hands and feet of persons. Mary has appeared to many, healed their sicknesses, etc. And anyone who's talked with their Catholic neighbors or seen depictions of the Catholic Church in some sort of media, perhaps in a movie or on television, you've seen these sort of things played out before your eyes. These are the sort of miracles that they claim to be able to perform or see performed. Durant, from his book, The Age of Faith, writes this about the Catholic Church. Catholic Church resisted, then used, then abused the cult of martyrs and relics. We talked about that a couple weeks ago, how they lionized these people who died for the faith. They called them saints, and they began to pray to them just as they prayed to God. That's what he's talking about in that first sentence. She opposed the worship of images and icons and warned her faithful that these should be reverenced only as symbols. But the ardor of public feeling overcame these cautions and led to the excesses that aroused the Byzantine iconoclast. So what he's basically saying is initially they kind of resisted the idolatry, but they finally gave in, so much so that they gave in to excess, which led to a doctrine known as iconoclasm, which was basically an attempt to get rid of all images out of the church. It ultimately failed. Continuing on, Catholic Church denounced magic, astrology, and divination, but medieval, like ancient literature, was full of them. Soon people and priests would use the sign of the cross as a magic incantation to expel or drive away demons. Exorcisms were pronounced over the candidate for baptism. So these are the sorts of signs, miraculous powers that the Catholic Church has historically claimed. And this connects us back once again to what Paul says in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse number 9, that there is a power at work in all this, but it's a power that intends to deceive, a power that intends to mislead. It looks like a lamb, but it talks like a dragon. The coming of a lawless one is according to the working of Satan, with all power, signs, and lying wonders. And it's worth mentioning, when you read the accounts of the plagues, the 10 plagues in the book of Exodus, you might recall that Pharaoh's magicians were able to imitate the first couple of plagues. Does anybody notice that? The Egyptian magicians, that's kind of a mouthful, isn't it? The Egyptian magicians are able to imitate those first couple of plagues. But they got to a point where they couldn't continue on, and they basically said to Pharaoh, look, we're out of tricks here. This is obviously the finger of God. These are the sorts of things we're talking about. There is a power behind this, but it's a lying power. The second beast was granted the authority to do these signs. They appear to be from God. He looks like a lamb, but he talks like a dragon. That gets us to the end of session 14. So I'm only running about 15 minutes late here this evening. Let me exit out of these notes real quick and switch over to session 15. And we'll go back and pick up in verse number 14. So we're in session 15. We're going to read chapter 13, verses 14 and 15, which is a bit of a repeat of what we just did. All right, continuing on about this second beast. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast, who was wounded by the sword and lived. He was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. Now, the big piece of symbolism in these two verses is this whole idea of the image of the beast. Let's just begin with a very basic question. What is an image? Well, it's a representation, right? And we're introduced to the concept of images very early in Scripture. An image is connected with mankind. We are all made in the image of God. Every person in this room, every person on this globe has been created in the image of God. And there's a lot of different ways that we can describe that or interpret it. We're all made up of three parts. We're spirit, soul, and body. God consists of three beings, Father, Word, and Spirit. So that's one way that we reflect the construction, if you will, of God. We are made in the image of God. And this is something that James emphasizes in James chapter 3, verse number 9. So that's one way to think of an image. It's a representation. We in some way manifest God. But primarily in Scripture, the idea of an image is connected with idolatry, right? So here we have a fabrication created by the papacy, a fabrication of the first beast. The first beast was to be worshipped, and mankind would be forced to worship the image of the beast. So it's like the first beast, it looks like the first beast, but it's separate from the first beast. Another interesting little component is that the second beast, the papacy, gives breath to the image. That to give breath to something means to give it life, to create it, to animate it. This should take us back again to the early chapters of Genesis, in this case, Genesis chapter 2, verse number 7. When God formed man of the dust of the ground, he breathed into man's nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul. So to give breath to the image is to give life to it. It's not an inanimate object, in other words. It's able to speak, as we learn later on. It's able to coerce people, compel them to follow its will. And as I just mentioned, the world will be compelled to worship the image of the beast. So just as the first beast is worshipped, so too this second beast, this image of the beast, would be worshipped under threat of death. Now I've heard several different ways to interpret this image of the beast. Some of you, I think one of you has Richard Reagan's notes from when he taught this back in the 1960s here at Pleasant Hill. And if you read through those notes, unless Richard changed his tune when I studied with him 40 years later or thereabouts, he believed the image of the beast was the Inquisition. I do think the Inquisition does fit into all of this, but I have a slightly different take on the image of the beast. I believe the image of the beast represents the Holy Roman Empire. This is something that Mike brought up a couple of weeks ago. And we haven't talked a lot about the Holy Roman Empire because, well, it just hasn't been relevant until this point, at least in my estimation. Let me lay a little bit of groundwork, though, because the Holy Roman Empire was a complete fabrication created by the papacy in cahoots with Charlemagne. Let me give you just a little bit of background here. I want to take you back to a man I introduced you to last week, a man by the name of Pepin the Short. Pepin the Short was a ruler in France that Pope Stephen II anointed to be the patrician of the Romans. And he anointed both Pepin the Short and his two sons to be given this title. And as I mentioned, this was a completely made-up title. This was something that, once again, Pope Stephen just invented and gave this title, bestowed this title on Pepin the Short. And the reason why he bestowed this title on Pepin was because Stephen II called Pepin down to defend Rome and the papacy from the Lombards, which was one of those tribes that was giving the Italian peninsula all sorts of problems in the 8th century. Well, Pepin the Short was victorious, and as we talked about, I believe last week, when we were talking about the two horns, he in 756 gave the papacy the papal states, thereby making the papacy not just a ruler in the kingdom of God, quote unquote, but also a ruler in the kingdoms of men. Now, Pepin the Short is important because Pepin the Short's son was Charles I, who we know as Charlemagne. And Charlemagne is a very important character in Western European history. And I think he's playing a bit of a role here in the book of Revelation. Now, let's fast forward about 40 years to the end of the 8th century. I'll introduce you to one more character here before we get into the nuts and bolts of the Holy Roman Empire. And it's a woman by the name of Empress Irene, who ruled in Byzantium, which is the Eastern Roman Empire. We talked about that back in the trumpets. Empress Irene of Byzantium. And she was not a very good person. She wanted the throne, and in order to acquire the throne, she blinded and deposed her son, who was the rightful heir to the throne, to become empress. This was a highly controversial move. Not only did she come to the throne in a very nasty way, but there was a lot of controversy surrounding her because a woman was sitting on the throne of Rome. Not literal Rome, but the Eastern Roman Empire, Byzantium. And the church, Catholic Church, the Orthodox Church, they saw this as a usurpation of man's authority. They thought that she was overturning man's authority. So Pope Leo III, who was the Bishop of Rome at this time, he would not acknowledge her as the true leader of the Roman Empire, which takes us to December 25th, 800 AD, an important day in world history. What's happening, though, in the days leading up to this is Pope Leo III, who I just mentioned, was in a bit of trouble. There was a lot of internal dissension within the Catholic Church. He was on the defensive. So Charlemagne comes down to Rome to defend Pope Leo and to affirm that he was the rightful occupant of Peter's chair. He is the Pope. He's the Bishop of Rome. We need to submit to him. And in return, on December 25th, 800, Pope Leo III crowned Charlemagne Emperor of the Roman Empire. And there's some debate among historians, and if you look this stuff up, what you'll find is there's some controversy over whether or not Charlemagne knew that the Pope was going to do this. There are a group of historians that think that Charlemagne and Leo had coordinated this together, and there are some who think that Leo III decided just to do this without consulting Charlemagne at all. But whichever interpretation is correct, whichever one was historically accurate, one thing is sure, Leo III was involved in this either way. And when he put the crown on Charlemagne's head, crowning him Emperor of the Roman Empire, this was celebrated by the people who were watching with these words: to Charles Augustus, crowned by God, to the great and pacific Emperor of the Romans, long life and victory. Now, once again, these things don't just happen overnight. There were signs of this leading up to this day. There were rumblings and developments, and I tend to lean toward the interpretation that Charlemagne was fully aware of what was going to happen on that fateful day, that he and Pope Leo III had coordinated together and conspired together to basically create a whole new empire out of nothing. And that's exactly what happened. The Encyclopedia Britannica, when you read their article on this particular item, says this: in considerable part, Charlemagne's coronation was the consequence of an idea shaped by the interpretation given to Charlemagne's actions as ruler. Over the years, some of the king's chief political, religious, and cultural advisors became convinced, notice this, that a new community was taking shape under the aegis of the king and the Frankish people, whom, as one pope avowed, the Lord God of Israel has blessed. They spoke of that community as the, and I'm terrible at reading Latin, so forgive me. They spoke of that community as the Imperium Christianum, comprising all who adhered to the Orthodox faith proclaimed by the Roman Church. We'll come back to that in a moment. This community accepted the dominion of a monarch increasingly hailed as the new David and the new Constantine, the guardian of Christendom and executor of God's will. Concerned for the welfare of the Imperium Christianum was heightened by the perceived unfitness of the heretical emperors in Constantinople to claim authority over the Christian community, especially after a woman, Irene, became Eastern Emperor in 797. Now, let me just highlight a few things in that quotation, because that's a long quotation, but I want to pull out some main ideas. Number one, they were sick and tired of the emperors over in the East. And when Irene came to the throne, the people in the West were tired, and they wanted somebody else. That's one thing to keep in mind. Number two, notice that they conceived of this as a new community. They were thinking of this as a new nation with a monarch that they thought of as the new David, the new Constantine. And this new nation would be completely in line with the Roman Church. It would become the guardian of the Roman Church. But it's important to underscore this point. This empire that Leo and Charlemagne created, even though they called it the Roman Empire, was not Roman. It was Frankish. It was French. It wasn't Roman at all. 300 years separated the fall of Rome in 476 and the crowning of Charlemagne in 800. And yet they claimed that it was the successor of the Roman Empire. They claimed an unbroken succession from the emperors of ancient Rome, what they called translatio imperii, or transfer of rule. But let's not overlook the fact that these first monarchs of this empire were French, what's known as the Carolingian dynasty. About a century and a half later, that dynasty was succeeded by Otto I, King of Germany, who was crowned the Emperor of Rome. So we have an empire that claims to be Roman, but was in fact French to begin with, and then later German. This is why Voltaire writes in 1756 that the Holy Roman Empire was neither holy nor Roman. It wasn't Roman at all. It was French and it was German, and we'll talk about why it wasn't holy here in just a moment. All of this, though, leads me to a critical, critical point. This was a complete fabrication. Pope Leo and Charlemagne worked together to create an empire out of nothing. Because the true successor to Rome was over in the East. It was in Byzantium. It was over there that you could trace the line of emperors back to Constantine, back to Marcus Aurelius, back to Augustus, back to the Roman Republic. There you could show an unbroken chain. That was the true successor of Rome, which means that the Pope had no legal rights. He had no claim to make Charlemagne the emperor, because Rome, the city of Rome, remained under the jurisdiction of Byzantium. So the coronation of Charlemagne as Roman emperor, this was completely illegal. I mean, this was a rebellion on the part of the papacy. And the Byzantines over in the East, they didn't see Charlemagne as a legitimate successor. They did not see him as a Roman emperor. They saw him as a usurper. They saw him as a Frankish king that was claiming something beyond his true station. So this leads me to a question. What is an empire that's created by a pope that looks like another empire, but has no historical connection to that empire, but claims to be that empire? The simple answer is, it's an image. It's an image. It looks like the Roman Empire. It calls itself the Roman Empire, but it's not really the Roman Empire at all. This was created by the papacy because they were tired of messing with the folks over in the East. So let me get someone on a throne that will work with me, that I can use as my pawn here in Europe and elsewhere. Norwich, in his book Absolute Monarchs, which is a book about the history of the papacy, writes this. Charles, talking about Charlemagne, Charles had received, as his enemies were quick to point out, only a title. The imperial crown brought with it not a single new subject or soldier, nor an acre of new territory. It was just a made-up name. Nothing else. But it was seen as legitimate. It was seen as legitimate because the Bishop of Rome had blessed it, had consecrated it, had put the crown on the head of Charlemagne. And this was certainly to the benefit of the papacy in the long run. Norwich goes on to comment later in that same book. There remains the question of why the Pope acted as he did. Not certainly to engineer a deliberate split in the Roman Empire, still less to bring about two rival empires where one had been before. There was, so far as he was concerned, no living emperor at the time. Very well, he would create one. And because the Byzantines had proved so unsatisfactory from every point of view, political, military, and doctrinal, he would select a Westerner, the one man who, by his wisdom and statesmanship and the vastness of his domains, as well as by his prodigious physical stature, stood head and shoulders above his contemporaries. And I just want to underscore a couple of things. The Pope created this. This was a complete creation, and it was to the papacy's advantage. As Norwich goes on to observe, but if Leo conferred a great honor on Charles that Christmas morning, he bestowed a still greater one on himself. The right to appoint and to invest with crown and scepter the emperor of the Romans. Here was something new, even revolutionary. No pontiff had ever claimed for himself such a privilege, not only establishing the imperial crown as his own personal gift, but simultaneously granting himself implicit superiority over the emperor whom he had created. So this had the benefits of enhancing the power of the papacy. It created an empire. It created a secular institution. It strengthened the standing of the Latin Church in terms of authority and influence. It solidified the supremacy of the papacy. And as we're going to see, it worked hand in glove with the papacy in many different ways. Let's move on now to verse 16. All right, we're still in session 15. We're ready for chapter 13, verse 16. He causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man. His number is 666. We've already talked about the meaning of the number 666. We did so several weeks ago. That's the word Latinos, the Latin kingdom, the Latin church. But let's talk for a few minutes about this mark. Because to receive a mark means, well, this represents a sign of ownership. To be marked means you belong to someone or something. In this case, it denotes ownership and allegiance to the first beast. And the reason I adopt that particular interpretation is because of what God says, or Moses says, in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 6 and 8. Here's what it means to be marked. And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. Notice that those words are to be a sign on your what? On your hand. They're to be frontlets between your eyes, or on your forehead, so to speak. So this mark denotes ownership. It denotes allegiance to the first beast. We have ample scriptural backing for that particular interpretation of the symbol. And again, that mark is equivalent to the name of the beast. It's equivalent to the number of his name, which again is Latinos, the number 666, verse number 18. And what I think this receiving of a mark represents is the gradual conversion of Western Europe to the Catholic Church. This is something that, of course, began with converting pagans to the Catholic Church. And, of course, this happened all over Europe. But it wasn't just a matter of converting pagans to Catholicism. You also had the converting of Arian Christians to Catholicism. We've gone back to the Council of Nicaea several different times throughout this study because it is a singular moment in world history. And at 325, one of the controversies that was debated was the doctrine of Arianism. And Arianism, its main tenet was a belief that Jesus Christ is a created being, that he is not God who has no beginning and no end. He has a definite beginning, that he was created by God. Our Jehovah's Witnesses, our neighbors in the Jehovah's Witness believe this, that Jesus is a created being. In fact, they believe that he's Michael the Archangel in human form, if I understand their doctrine correctly. Now, the reason I bring up this conversion of Arian Christians to Catholicism is a lot of those Germanic tribes, those barbarian tribes that invaded the Roman Empire, a lot of them were actually Arian Christians. This, again, comes from the Encyclopedia Britannica. It maintained favor among some groups, most notably some of the Germanic tribes, to the end of the 7th century. So what you have happening in Europe is a gradual conversion to Catholicism, not just paganism to Catholicism, but also different flavors or different forms of Christianity to Catholicism. That's the mark of the beast, Latinos, the Latin church, the Church of Rome. No dissent was allowed by the Catholic Church. No other sects were permitted. It was a complete doctrinal hegemony that they created in Europe. You could not claim to be any other flavor of Christianity. You had to be Catholic. This was the mark of the beast. We see this back in the 7th chapter of Daniel. Daniel chapter 7, verse 24. The little horn, who I believe represents the papacy, we see him subduing three kings. Now, the 10 horns in both Daniel 7 as well as Revelation 13 and Revelation 17, these represent those Germanic tribes that migrated from what we would call Western Russia into Europe, that eventually conquered the Roman Empire, and these eventually become the Western European powers. Three of those horns were subdued. And what we see happening in the very late part of the 6th century, during the reign of Pope Gregory the First, who's called Gregory the Great, is we see three major conversions that were instigated by Pope Gregory. He put in motion the conversion of Visigothic Spain. They were converted from Arianism to Catholicism. Also during his reign, the Anglo-Saxons up in England, actually beyond the far eastern tip of England and what was known as Kent, they were converted from paganism to Catholicism. And I call them Anglo-Saxons, although it's a little bit difficult to sort out who were the Angles and who were the Saxons. They just kind of all ended up calling themselves Saxons eventually, and then they eventually called themselves English, right? Which comes from the whole angle thing. Anyways, they were converted from paganism. And then Pope Gregory the First also put in motion the conversion of Frankish Gaul, their conversion from Arianism to Catholicism. So this seems to me to fit very nicely with this whole idea of subduing three kings, receiving the mark of the beast, so to speak. And these are three very important powers that are aligned with the church. Now, Spain's going to have some problems when the Muslims invade from North Africa in the 8th century. But it's going to, parts of it are going to remain staunchly Catholic all the way down to our day, obviously, as well as France. And, well, England's kind of a mess, but we've already gone through some of that in the past. So that seems to kind of link up with what we see happening in Daniel chapter 7, this idea of converting to Catholicism. But what happens to those who will not receive the mark? Well, the unmarked will be killed. And I'll just give you one example of how I think this plays out. Historically, those who refuse to be converted to Catholicism would die. One of the reasons why Charlemagne was given the crown, was crowned the emperor of the Roman Empire, was because of the successful campaign he waged against the Saxons, what's known as the Saxon Wars, from 772 to 804. And as he conquered Saxony, he put into place, again, another one of those Latin phrases that I'm not going to even try to butcher. I'm just going to give you the English translation. He put into place several ordinances, and these were known as the Ordinances Concerning Saxony. Number 8 is of particular interest. If any one of the race of the Saxons hereafter concealed among them shall have wished to hide himself unbaptized, and shall have scorned to come to baptism, and shall have wished to remain a pagan, let him be punished by death. Remember, we're talking about the image of the beast. And what does the image of the beast do? It compels those who do not have the mark of the beast to receive the mark of the beast. And anybody who refuses, anybody who does not convert to Catholicism is going to be killed. So anybody who does not submit to the authority of the image of the beast is going to be put to death. He also, in those ordinances, imposed the death penalty for the destruction of churches and violating the Lenten fast. So if you didn't get with the program, there is only one thing you were going to get. You were going to get the sword. So anyone who resisted would end up, in the end, dying. And dissenters would also be ostracized. Notice in those verses we're told that those who do not have the mark of the beast could not buy or sell. We'll talk about that some more when we get into chapter 18 later on in June, because what we're going to see is this was not just a political hegemony that the papacy enacted there in Western Europe, but it's an economical one as well. You might recall from our past discussions how all of those church councils were urging the secular authorities to extirpate heresy, to root out heresy. You got to get rid of the heretics in your area. But you might recall that, you know, those secular authorities, they really weren't all that keen to do that kind of damage to the people that they were ruling. And eventually what happens over the course of about 4 centuries is the church gets very frustrated because there's a lot of heresy happening, particularly in southern France. You've got some groups like the Cathars, for example, who just will not submit. They will not convert to the Catholic Church. And the Catholic Church is putting immense pressure on these local nobles to root out the heresy, but they're not doing it. So what does the papacy do? Well, eventually it creates this thing that's called the Inquisition. I'm not going to take the time to read that quote because we got to get moving. Otherwise, I'm not going to be able to get through the end of chapter 13, and I want to finish it tonight. So let's talk about the Inquisition. And a lot of times you hear the phrase the Inquisition, and what pops into our mind is the Spanish Inquisition. Well, that was just one part of the Inquisition. The Inquisition actually lasted for several centuries. It began in the 1200s, primarily in southern France, but it ended up spreading all over Europe. There were tribunals all over Europe that were devoted to searching out and suppressing heresies. Bishops visited any place in their diocese, any town, any part of their diocese where there were rumors of heretics. They'd visit those places 1 to 2 times a year, and if they could find heretics, they were put on trial. If those heretics recanted, they were given penance. And we'll talk about their penance here in just a moment, because it's probably going to give you some goosebumps when we begin to talk about what their penance looked like. If they recanted, if they gave in, if they went ahead and converted to the Catholic Church, they were given penance. If they resisted, they were tortured until they recanted. And I want to underscore this particular point. They weren't killed immediately. Now, some of them did face capital punishment in the end if they remained faithful. If they did not convert, they eventually were killed. But really what these people wanted is they wanted people to convert. They saw this as the salvation of their souls. So they were often tortured in very imaginative ways until they would just finally give in. And if they didn't give in, they died, and it was usually by fire. This was considered the ultimate punishment. Now, I'm going to put a couple of images up here. One of them is going to look eerily familiar. Anybody ever seen an image like that before? If you've watched movies about Germany in the 1930s and the 1940s, you will have seen something like that. But that's actually something that's very, very old. In 1215, during the Fourth Lateran Council, led by Pope Innocent III, and again, Pope Innocent III is one of those luminaries in the papacy, and his name, Innocent III, could not be more poorly chosen, because this man was anything but innocent. Anyways, in the Fourth Lateran Council, in Canon 68, this is what was declared. Jews and Saracens, or Muslims, of both sexes in every Christian province and at all times shall be marked off in the eyes of the public from other peoples through the character of their dress. If you were a Jew living in Western Europe in the Middle Ages, this is what you had to wear. You had to mark yourself clearly on your clothing as a Jew. And do you know what that led to? Persecution. You were ostracized from society. Hitler wasn't inventing things in the 1930s and 40s. He was just borrowing things from several centuries earlier. And it wasn't just the Jews who were marked out, or the Muslims. I mentioned the Cathars earlier. This was a heretical sect in southern France. Those Cathars who, under torture, recanted and agreed to convert to Catholicism, as part of their penance, they would have to sew onto their clothing a yellow badge in the shape of a cross. And you can imagine how life might be difficult for you in a society where you are one of the few people wearing a star or a cross. It would become very difficult for you. And you were cut off from things like buying and selling. But what do we see in chapter 13? We've been talking about chapter 13 longer than any other chapter in the book of Revelation, and that has been by design. If we can understand chapter 13, if we can see the historical connections, that sets us up to talk about the rest of the book and to see how the rest of the book unfolds. And we'll be moving quite a bit more quickly in the next few weeks. But what are the warnings that we, as the people of God, can take away from chapter 13? Well, we see that the saints who lived during this time would be persecuted for about 42 months. And we talked about how that represents 1,260 days or 1,260 years, basically the period that we historically call the Middle Ages. That during this time period, the saints would be persecuted. But the message to those who live during this time is, keep yourself pure. Keep yourself pure, otherwise you're going to suffer the same punishment. And we're going to see that later on in chapter 14. Because chapter 14 is all about the goodness and severity of God. For those who remain faithful, for those few who remain faithful even to the point of death, for those few there is a reward laid up in heaven. But for those who recanted, for those who went back, punishment awaits. Whoever receives the mark of the beast would be punished. Another warning of chapter 13 is do not be deceived by these beasts. These beasts may appear to be from God. They may appear to have all the hallmarks of originating with God, but don't be deceived by them. There's another power at work behind the scenes. And if it's necessary, be willing to lay down your life. And in a lot of cases, that's what was demanded of those who remained faithful. They had to be faithful till death. Now, let's just give a little bit of a look ahead. Here's where we're moving in the future. So next week, we're going to get into chapter 14. Technically, I've got chapter 14 in your notes for this week, but we're going to have to start that next week. Chapter 14 is the conclusion of Vision 3. And as I just mentioned, chapter 14 is the goodness and severity of God. You've got God blessing the faithful and God judging the wicked. Chapters 15 through 19 are vision number 4. And these 5 chapters basically show us the judgment of these two beasts in Revelation 13. The beast, first beast, and the false prophet. The false prophet is just another way of describing that second beast, the dragon that looks like a lamb. Vision number 5 is in chapter 20. This is the judgment of the dragon. If you'll notice, there's some symmetry happening here, right? Chapter 12 is the dragon. Chapter 13 is the beast and the false prophet. Chapter 14 is the judgment day. And then we hinge to the judgment of the two beasts and the judgment of the dragon. So there's some nice symmetry in chapters 13 through 20. And of course, chapters 21 and 22 that you're probably already familiar with, to one degree or another, represent heaven or the reward that awaits us all. So that's where we're headed here the next, well, we'll get to as much as we can the next couple of weeks, but we're really going to have to delay most of this until June when we're together again. My plan is to get through chapters 14 and 15 next week, and we'll get into chapter 16 the last Wednesday night this month, and I think I can finish it at one Wednesday night, believe it or not.